So coming into Harding University my freshman year, I think four words perfectly summed up my attitude whenever I arrived, and that was big man on campus. I thought I was going to take over the school whenever I got there. So laced with Axe body spray, a little bit of peach fuzz forming on my upper lip, and a ridiculous amount of self-confidence, I came into my freshman year thinking I was going to be the man. I thought I'd be able to pretty much pick whatever wife I wanted. I thought I'd be able to dominate whatever sport I played in. And most importantly, I thought I was going to flex my Bible knowledge to all my peers and my Bible professors. Well, turns out none of those things were true. Beginning with the person I picked to be my wife on day one that I stepped foot on Harding's campus and even prayed to God about our future children, she ended up giving me really strong vibes immediately that I was in the friend zone whenever she asked to watch a movie with me. And then whenever I go into the room to watch the movie with her, she's sitting on a couch that sits three, sitting in between two other guys. And the spot open for me was this tiny little chair off to the side, and honestly, from that angle, I couldn't even see the screen. But I had a really good view of the potential love of my life being taken from me before my very eyes. I learned really quickly in that moment, as years moved on, it was revealed that I was not, in fact, Harding's heartthrob. But you know what? At least I was a baller. I mean, people needed to understand, I played high school basketball in the highest division in Missouri. What are these chumps in Searcy, Arkansas going to have against me? So one of the first weekends I'm playing basketball, I play a guy one-on-one. He's like 5 inches shorter than me, and on paper, I should have absolutely owned him. I should have destroyed him. But he proceeds to metaphorically pants me for the entire game. He stole the ball from me like 8 times. I'm not exaggerating that. It was embarrassing. I mean, it was like I was playing Shaq, except I was the taller one. It was such an uncomfortable experience, and then I figured out that I was not the freak athlete that I thought I was. But here's the thing, at least I had Bible. All right, I knew my Bible pretty well. I was killing it in Bible bulls. And if there was one thing I knew that all women found that wildly attractive. So every time I was in my freshman Bible class, if my teacher ever had a question, I had the answer. And I would always be nice, like I would give my competition a chance to answer the question, but after those 2 seconds were up, I immediately raised my hand and just started talking. And everything was working great. Until all of a sudden, my professor starts talking about these different Jewish groups that I've never heard before, and then he mentions this biblical source called Q. And I'm like, what's a Q? Like, that's not even the Bible. Like, I know the songs, or I know the song for the books of the Bible. I know it's not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Q. Like, where does that come in? And then as the semester progressed, he kept saying more and more stuff that I haven't heard before, and I was like, huh. Well, I think I'm going to let the person with the PhD be the professor again, and I'm just going to step back and not teach the class anymore. So it turns out that I was not, in fact, the big man on campus. In fact, I was just an average dingus. And though I kid a lot about what I was like my freshman year, the underlying motive and the heart behind all of those things is really not a laughing matter, because those stories are all a part of a lifelong struggle of mine. And it's something that rears its ugly head in all of our lives. It's that feeling that I am the center of the universe, that people are going to respect the title on my name or respect the degree that I have earned, that feeling that I received a grade way too low or I'm the one that should have gotten that promotion over this person. It's the thing that keeps us from saying sorry in all of our relationships. It's going to leave us ultimately in isolation away from a loving community. And it's the root of every sin in existence. And it is going to burn your life down faster than you know what's going to hit you. It goes by the name of pride. Right now we're going through a series on villains of the Bible, and a villain that is of particular closeness to my own heart is Nebuchadnezzar. Wait. Nebuchadnezzar? Gesundheit. That's the kind of name that you have to Google to make sure you spell right. And in my head, like I always have to say Nebuchadnezzar to make sure I spell it right whenever I write it out. It's a name that doesn't quite roll off the tongue, you know. Unfortunately, you don't see Christians giving their kids the name Nebuchadnezzar too often. But could you imagine that, though? Like in roll call, John Brown, here. Caitlin Crow, here. Nebuchadnezzar Dingus? No, yeah, I'm here. You can just call me Chad for short, though. you don't hear that's kind of a missed opportunity, I think. I think we need to capitalize on giving kids the name Nebuchadnezzar. But even though that name's kind of weird to us, I'll tell you what. Nebuchadnezzar thought his name was something. He thought it was so powerful and so important that every city that he conquered, the biggest buildings that were in those cities, he would inscribe his name and just brag about himself for a while. He thought he was amazing. And the Bible, man, they hate the name Nebuchadnezzar. The biblical authors do not like Nebuchadnezzar at all. You get a glimpse of how much biblical authors hate the name Nebuchadnezzar from the book of Ezra. Ezra, in any and every chance that he gets to throw shade to Nebuchadnezzar, he does it. If you look at Ezra 5:12, it says, "But our ancestors angered the God of heaven. He gave them into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar the Chaldean, king of Babylon, who destroyed this temple and deported the people to Babylon." And then a couple verses down, he says, "He even removed from the temple of Babylon the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which, in case you all forgot, which I'm not going to let you forget, Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to the temple in Babylon." And there are several instances of this in the book of Nebuchadnezzar. He is not going to let people forget who did this to God's people. He wants to drag Nebuchadnezzar's name through the mud. So without question, the Bible sees Nebuchadnezzar as a villain. But specifically in the book of Daniel, we're able to get a little look behind the curtain and see what makes him tick. And you may not think that you have a lot in common with a very rich and powerful king that lived 2,500 years ago, but you'll be surprised because you're going to see that Nebuchadnezzar is somebody that you see walking around every day. So when reading about Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, one of the first things to note is how much Nebuchadnezzar has conditioned the people around him to stroke his ego. You see this, his closest people around him, the wise men, the astrologers, these sorcerers, they were all some of the think tank for Nebuchadnezzar. And anytime you see them interact with him, you see all this flattery, like calling him great and mighty and your majesty. Like you don't ever see someone come up to him and be like, "Hey, Chad, how's it hanging?" It's always like, "This is serious." And that's because pride demands that people respect your status. Nebuchadnezzar was like that athlete every time that they score or make a big play, they point to the name on the back of their jersey. They try to glorify themselves as much as possible. Or maybe that professor that you've had before that will never, ever, ever have them be referred to in their first name. They're always going to be like, "No, call me Dr. So-and-so." That comes from the place of pride. And we get a first glimpse of this with Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2:4. Essentially, Nebuchadnezzar, he has this troubling dream and he wants these wise men to interpret it for him. And in verse 4, they all start with flattery, like you do when you're talking with people in power. They say, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." And Nebuchadnezzar says, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But, you know, if you tell me the dream and explain it to me, then I'll give you gifts and honor and rewards. So just tell me the dream and interpret it for me." That is crazy. That's like you're dealing with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde right here. He is either going to kill you for getting something trivial wrong, or he's going to give you all the best things in the world. It's kind of crazy. Can you imagine why people are such a kiss up to him? Like, are you going to disagree with a guy who's going to cut you to pieces for getting something trivial wrong? And Nebuchadnezzar then reminds them again that there is only one penalty for failure. And we see all that false bravado from these wise men just disappear. And they say, "There is no one who can do this for you, king." This threat from Nebuchadnezzar, it seems crazy, but this is another thing that pride does. Pride does not tolerate inconvenience and seeks punishment. It's that feeling inside of us whenever we feel so wronged about how long it's taking to get through this grocery line right now. Like, I wish the cashier lady and the person that she's talking to, I wish they would stop talking. Don't they know I have places to be? And then you want to kind of say something mean to those people. Or maybe whenever you're sitting in a restaurant and the waiter and waitress, they get your order wrong, or they're taking forever to get your food to you, and you're like, "You know what? I'm going to reflect that on your tip." Or it's that time whenever you're sitting in standstill traffic and there's a lane that's about to end and everybody has to merge over and there's a guy that just skips everything and he merges right in front of you and you want to introduce them to the universal sign of, I am not fond of you right now. Because whenever we feel like the world revolves around us, we have very little patience and very little grace. So after the wise men can't deliver for Nebuchadnezzar, he then follows through with what he said and sends these people to their deaths for not being able to interpret his dream. So he sends the guards out and they sweep up all the wise men. And included in that group would have been an exile from Jerusalem named Daniel. And Daniel hears about this. He's like, okay, this is a really harsh punishment. Maybe I can interpret the dream like you do whenever you're going to get killed if you can't. So Nebuchadnezzar gets brought before, Daniel gets brought before Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel hears about this dream for the first time, and the dream portrays this massive statue made of different metals that ultimately gets destroyed, and all that's left is the rock that destroyed it. And then Daniel begins to interpret what this dream meant for him in verse 37. He said, Your Majesty, you see the flattery, the kiss up there, you are the King of Kings. And King of Kings is just a title that denotes the world dominance. He is a king above other kings. Other kings to him are like servants. And he continues, The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds in the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. Do you hear that Genesis 1 language there? It's that same sort of language where God gives authority and power over to Adam and Eve. This is signifying that this is a God-given gift, this power that Nebuchadnezzar has. And at this moment, he probably has more of it than anyone else on the earth. And then Daniel says something that I think plants an idea in Nebuchadnezzar's head. He says, You are the head of gold. And I think from that point on, Nebuchadnezzar just stopped listening to the rest of the interpretation because the interpretation was really, really negative. It was really bad. It was going on to talk about how his empire and successive empires would fall in place of essentially the kingdom of God to be established forever. But he didn't hear any of that. You lost them at head of gold. I imagine whenever the interpretation finished, Nebuchadnezzar's just kind of sitting there like, So you're telling me that I'm the head of gold? That's amazing. Hey, guards, get in here. Okay, I have this crazy idea. I'm just kind of spitballing here. What if we made this massive golden statue, completely gold, like forget the other elements and whatnot there. Let's just go all gold, make it of me, a massive image of me. And what if, like, we made everybody just bow down and worship that? I think that would be good. I think that feels good to me. So how about we go through with that? Daniel, you're a genius. I love the idea. And I just imagine Daniel like, ugh. I don't think you could have possibly gotten a worse takeaway from what I just said. But this is something else that pride does. Pride reinterprets reality to fit what we want. It's like in Dumb and Dumber, if you've seen that movie, whenever Jim Carrey's character is talking to the lady that he likes so much, and he asks what the chances of them being together is, and she says 1 in 1,000,000, aka not happening. But he hears it as, So you're telling me there's a chance? It's what causes us to continue eating bacon after the doctor says, quit eating bacon or you're going to die. But it's like, you know, I've made it this far in life, eating bacon, and, you know, there's protein in bacon, therefore bacon is healthy, therefore I will keep eating bacon. I'm sorry, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. Because the problem, it never lies with us. The problem is always a them thing. So reinterpreting this dream in a favorable light, Nebuchadnezzar then keeps Daniel close, because he sees him as an asset. From this point on, Nebuchadnezzar uses Daniel as a tool for self-improvement, because pride sees relationships as tools. Relationships are a means for pride, not the end. You're not in a relationship simply to be in a relationship. You're in a relationship to see what you can get out of it. Maybe you're choosing friends that are going to help enhance your status, and you're trying to stay away from people that might lower your status. Or maybe it's whenever you want to meet with people only for what they can provide you, but not out of a truly loving relationship. So then in Daniel 3, we see Nebuchadnezzar build this massive golden statue that's 60 cubits high. And in case you don't have your cubit measuring stick with you today, that is the equivalent of 90 feet. And if you want something to compare that to, that's about the same size as the Christ the Redeemer statue in Brazil. So he builds this massive, fully golden image of himself for everybody to bow down and worship every time they heard the loud instrument and worship him as their king. And oh, in typical Nebuchadnezzar fashion, if they didn't do that, they'd be thrown into a fiery furnace. And again, this is probably why everybody was a kiss up to this guy. So after initiating this decree, so far it seems like it's working. Everybody's bowing down. Things are going great. Except for these three pesky protesting Hebrews who decide to stand and not bow when everybody else does. And Nebuchadnezzar loses his mind. He tells the guards to stoke the flames of the furnace 7 times hotter than what it normally is. And it gets so hot that the guard that then grabs those men and throws them in dies just from being in close proximity to the furnace. If you go to the dictionary definition of overkill, you're probably going to find an example of this here. But in this instance, we see that Nebuchadnezzar could not handle the thought of someone not seeing him as great as he saw himself. And this is another thing with pride. Pride seeks acceptance and crumbles from rejection. And man, is this true of our world. We hate it when people don't like us. And I think social media is the perfect example of this. We make a post, it's our little brainchild, it's our baby we put out there, and then it gets met with criticism or harsh comments, and it's crushing. And then it'll make you, if it's not crushing, which it still probably is, it'll still make you want to retaliate and comment mean things back to the other person. Or maybe even worse with this is the creation of the like and the favorite button. We found a way as humans to quantify our worth based upon the numbers of likes we have on a post, and we compare ourselves to each other. And it's crushing whenever we make something and it doesn't get as many likes as we want. But it's not until we find our acceptance first from God that then rejection starts to crumble. So the pride of Nebuchadnezzar continues in chapter 4, and this comes in response to another dream. And this dream portrays a massive image that has, it's a tree of with a ton of really lush fruit. It's a beautiful tree, and then that tree gets cut down, and all that's left is a little stump. And essentially, this was a dream warning Nebuchadnezzar that he would ultimately be brought low and live in reason with animals in isolation. Daniel tells him that you're about to fall. So what I would suggest is to renounce your sins, stand up for the oppressed, do what is right, be kind to people, and then maybe God will allow your prosperity to continue. But Nebuchadnezzar wasn't hearing any of that because pride refuses to admit wrongdoing. How often is that true for us? Whenever we're in an argument with somebody, and maybe sometimes especially when we know that we are wrong, it is really, really hard to admit it. It is hard to admit that we're wrong and apologize. And I mean, if you think about every political debate ever, you see this. People are very staunch, and I don't think one time I've ever seen someone be like, you know, that's a good point. I'm going to change my policy on that. Everybody, let's go with that. No, people are always going to fight tooth and nail for their own beliefs and ideas and never think that they're wrong. If you watch any sports talk show, any of them, there are people who have these horrible, horrible takes that make no sense, and they are obviously wrong, and the next day they come and debate about it, and they try to find a way to spin it and make it seem like they weren't as wrong as they really were. That all comes from pride. And in relationships and marriages, we know that this happens all the time, and Abby knows that this is all too true for me. It's hard to admit whenever we're wrong, and it's hard to say, I'm sorry, but each time you do that, you kill pride. So Nebuchadnezzar, he ultimately doesn't heed Daniel's warning because he feels like he's been in the right. He continued living his life as normal because it got him this far in life. And then we see this scene 1 year later in verse 30 as Nebuchadnezzar is looking off the top of his royal palace. And he says this, "Is this not the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" And that was the last straw. Nebuchadnezzar looked at his spectacular kingdom. He looked at his creation and said, "It is good. Look at what I made. Look at what I did." All the while forgetting that this was a gift given to him by God. Because pride mistakes blessing for entitlement. It's like thinking that we've pulled ourselves up from our own bootstraps, that I practiced every day to get here. I made this company myself. But how much can we possibly think that we have earned in life? The fact that you were even born is a gift. How could we have reached the success that we did without the help of God and the life circumstances that we have been given? Because every good thing that is a part of us is a gift from the only good gift giver. How foolish is it to think that we have done something with ourselves when there is a being who actually breathes galaxies into existence? But Nebuchadnezzar lost that perspective. Pride made him out to be the center of the universe. Pride made him give glory to self and not to God. And though we may not see Nebuchadnezzar as relatable to us on the surface, from what I've seen, Nebuchadnezzar is all over the place. As humans in this culture especially, we are so self-centered. We are continually drifting towards individualism and away from community. We have social media accounts that only show the highlights of our life. We're trying to show how great we are. We created phones that have front-facing cameras on them so we can have more and more images of ourselves in front of us. There's an increasing emphasis on self-care, some of which is good, like mental health, for example, I've been benefited greatly from. But we are continuing to care more and more and more about self. We glorify bragging, narcissistic, massively successful, rich people. We are largely a self-obsessed culture. Seems to me that Nebuchadnezzar is still ruling today. But living like Nebuchadnezzar isn't without consequence. The bill ultimately comes due for him, and we see this in verse 31. Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox. Seven times will pass by until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like feathers of an eagle and nails like the claws of a bird, aka he became the next monster for the next horror movie, Freddy Krueger's long-lost brother. In this moment, Nebuchadnezzar, he became the poster child for the pride comes before the fall trope. And like we see in so many movies and so many TV shows, and in reality in the lives of people around us all the time, if we go on without understanding who the true center of the universe is, this is where it leads. It leads to isolation. It leads to having no support and wondering how on earth you got to a place so low. This is what we call rock bottom. Because living a pride-filled life will burn your life down faster than Nebuchadnezzar's furnace. But here's the good news. The story doesn't end here for Nebuchadnezzar, because even though the Hebrews hated him, God loved him. Just as Nebuchadnezzar is the poster child for pride coming before the fall, he is also the poster child for the prodigal son. From that famous parable of Jesus, just after the son squanders all his wealth and power and his metaphorical empire away, he too finds himself like Nebuchadnezzar, eating and reasoning among the animals. And though Nebuchadnezzar and the prodigal son had their wealth, power, and status stripped from them, they found a gift that many of us tend to find. In the lives of those who live a pride-filled life, there often comes a point where you fail at something so miserably. You do something so bad you seemingly can't recover from. Your image is permanently tarnished. It takes a permanent hit. And then you realize how frail you are whenever you once felt so strong. And though on the surface, those are all things that all of us try to avoid like the plague, like we don't ever want to fail. We don't want to fail. But it brings about the greatest and most surprising gift, humiliation. Because if pride is the door to everything bad, humiliation is the door to everything good. In fact, the path of humiliation is actually the path to salvation. And I'm not just talking like heaven and hell stuff. I'm talking a holistic, life deliverance. Humiliation strips from us all the things that we don't need. Humiliation delivers us from status seeking because we have the correct perspective that we're really not that great in the grand scheme of things. Humiliation kills our desire to care for ourselves before other people because we realize that we are no more important than anybody else. Humiliation delivers us by killing our egos, enabling us to be fully present in each and every moment. Humiliation helps us see that when there is nothing left to lose, there is profound freedom and a chance for all of us to start a new life. And if you don't believe me, hear it from Nebuchadnezzar. Listen to how his perspective shifts with humiliation. In verse 37, he says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven because everything he does is right. All of his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble." God can humble us so fast that we won't even know what hit us. And you may not have experienced that sort of deep level of humiliation yet, but you could be just one more bad grade or one more failed project or one more moral failure away from hitting it. But my encouragement is don't wait for it to happen. Instead of living a prideful life waiting to be humiliated, save yourself the trouble because living a life of pride is extremely difficult to undo. There are real consequences to this. For example, Nebuchadnezzar's son took up Nebuchadnezzar's original example and lived a life of pride, never repented from it, and he ended up dying a gruesome death and lost his empire. The key to avoiding the severe downfall of Nebuchadnezzar in your own life is to say yes to humiliation now. I'm not saying right now everybody go out of this building and try to embarrass themselves as fast as humanly possible, but what I'm saying is be looking for it. Because, you know, we're all really sloppy people, and it's not like mistakes are hard to come by. What I'm saying is, in those moments, don't meet it with defensiveness. Don't meet it with self-justification. Enter into it. Don't take yourself too seriously. Learn to laugh at yourself. And I'm really hoping I can practice what I preach here, because this is something that does not come naturally to me at all. Jonathan gave me some really good advice. And he said, whenever you're living your life, kind of constantly have this music be playing in your head. It's kind of silly, but you get the point with that. It helps you have the right perspective of yourself. You don't take yourself too seriously. You're recognizing who the big deal is, and it's not you. And can you imagine what a world without ego would look like? There would be no more world hunger. There would be world peace. Every single person in existence would have a loving community. There would be no marginalized people anymore. And though that feels like a fantasy, that feels like an unrealistic dream, it's actually the reality of this new kingdom. Little did Nebuchadnezzar know that the rock that destroyed his statue or his empire, it gave way to a new kingdom and a new King of Kings. A king who didn't consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing. God made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant in many different ways, washing his disciples' feet, caring for those who were marginalized. And he chose to take the humiliating position by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And if you don't know, the humiliation of the cross was probably worse than the pain that you would feel. It was such a shameful thing. And the thing that blows my mind every time I think about Philippians 2 is that our God willingly chose to humiliate himself. And that is the fullest representation, fullest revelation of who he is him on a cross. This is ushering in the new kingdom. The old way of ruling saw its final nail in the coffin through nail-pierced hands. Those who rule like Nebuchadnezzar, they get stripped of their authority. And all authority is then given to this meek, servant-like carpenter named Jesus. And at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow to him. Every tongue will confess, and all the world will recognize who the true majesty of the universe is. And now that there's a new king on the throne, the value system of Nebuchadnezzar's regime has to be destroyed. Under this king, we don't care about our status anymore. Under this king, we don't need to brag on ourselves because we know our worth from God. Under this king, we're quick to apologize and admit all of our wrongs. Under this king, we turn the other cheek whenever we're inconvenienced. Under this king, we look at people as beloved children of God and not as obstacles to move around. Under this king, we lead with grace and leave the judgment to God. Under this king, we listen to our opponents because we care more about the relationship with them than looking like we have the right answers. Under this king, we serve others without giving glory to ourselves and direct all of it to where it is due. Under this king, we see people who see themselves like your great majesty Nebuchadnezzar turn into people who say, no, you can just call me Chad.